Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings for today's discussion on internal displacement in Afghanistan. My name is Andrew Solomon. I'm a fellow here at Brookings and also the deputy director of the Brookings Byrne Project on Internal Displacement, which is finalizing a study conducted in collaboration with the Liaison Office, an Afghani NGO and research organization, on the situation of internally displaced persons and their protection in the southern Afghan province of Kandahar. Today, TLO and Brookings would like to share with you some of the general themes and findings of our study, and this will involve a discussion of the causes of displacement in the south, the gaps in IDP protections, how those who have been displaced are coping, and also an exploration of international and national efforts to respond to displacement and facilitate durable solutions throughout the country in general, as well as in Kandahar in particular. As you are likely aware, Kandahar will play an important part in the recently announced strategy to secure the country and to strengthen state capacity and governance institutions through the deployment of additional military and civilian personnel. In addition, Kandahar has been the site of intense battles and kinetic activity involving the Afghan insurgency and the Afghan National Security Forces and International Security Forces. In addition, Kandahar is also host to one of the largest IDP populations throughout the country. And unfortunately, because of the insecurity in the province and the violence there, humanitarian access has been severely limited. And until recently, relatively little has been known about the situation of internally displaced persons there. Now, today, fortunately, we have with us several experts in this field who can increase our awareness and understanding of the situation in the South with regards to internal displacement based on their familiarity with the area and time spent on the ground, including 2 months over the course of the summer interviewing roughly 150 internally displaced persons, as well as representatives of the Afghan government, NGOs, and international humanitarian agencies, and military forces. I'm pleased to be able to present, sitting on my immediate left, the first of our two researchers, Dr. Suzanne Schmeidel, who is co-founder of and senior advisor to TLO, the Liaison Office. And sitting next to Suzanne is Mr. Alex Mundt, who worked for over 2 years in Afghanistan for UNHCR and who worked here at Brookings as a guest researcher this past year. We're also very pleased to have with us on the panel, sitting next to Alex, Mr. Ashraf Hadari, representing the Embassy of Afghanistan, followed by Mr. Keith Eikenes of the Embassy of Norway. Mr. Eikenes will get us underway today, but before I turn it over to him, I would like to thank the government of Norway for their longtime support for the IDP project here and our work. So with that, Keith, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Keith Eikenes, and I am a counselor at the Norwegian Embassy here in Washington. And first of all, thank you for the opportunity for me to come here today the opportunity to come and present the report that has just been finished. It's with great honor, I think, that Norway has taken part in this report and supported it. I've been able to read through most of it. And I think it's a very solid report, and I've also forwarded it to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Oslo, who have commented very positively on it as well. So I think it's a very good report that offers some very interesting and I think relevant recommendations. And I think the report is published at a very relevant time. As you briefly mentioned, there's a new there's a revised uh, or slightly revised Afghan strategy now being launched, and there's in some ways a refocused international effort underway in Afghanistan. And I think the perspectives that this report brings to bear are very important, and that we the situation of IDPs is something that needs to be given more attention as the international community continues its efforts in Afghanistan. The situation for IDPs is very, very serious. The number that I have is 230,000, which is a very large number, and as the report points out, there has not been sufficient focus on the IDP challenges from the international community so far, and I hope that this report will contribute to raising the awareness of this very serious issue. Norwegian efforts in this area, I'll say something briefly. A large part of our humanitarian aid to Afghanistan is related to refugee and IDP issues. In 2009, we spent about $20 million U.S. dollars on refugee issues as a whole, but a lot of this was also meant to address the IDP problem. As the report points out, there are some gaps in our efforts to address this question. In our view, from the Norwegian perspective, we believe that the returnee programs in Afghanistan, they need to be strengthened and better integrated with local community development initiatives. Rural areas, as the report also states, are found to be more insecure, and thus leading to a pressure towards urban areas where land and housing is scarce. And the capacity of the return program, unfortunately, are very exhausted. And the UNHCR acknowledges this, and we'll look into how it, for the meantime, can support refugees in their camps and homes rather than supporting, you know, more voluntary returns. And in terms of, I'm actually from the Defense Department in Norway, so it's important. An important perspective for me is that the IDP issue is also, it's not simply a humanitarian issue, but it's also a security issue with huge potential for destabilizing Afghanistan. I also thought the recommendations in the report regarding the international military presence in Afghanistan was particularly interesting, and I think it's a very valid point that as we develop and implement a counterinsurgency strategy, I think the IDP question needs to be taken more seriously into account. And that is a challenge for the U.S., but it's also a challenge for the Norwegian Army and the Norwegian forces that operate in Afghanistan. And I think the report talks a lot about the international military forces, but I also think there needs to be an effort to sensitize the growing number of Afghan national security forces. Within not too long, we'll have 144,000 ANA soldiers operating in Afghanistan. And I think also on the Afghan side, increasing the awareness and bringing the IDP perspective to the forefront will be important. I think with that, I'll conclude my remarks and pass it on to my next colleague on the panel, and look forward to the Q&A session.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. On behalf of the Afghan government and people, I would like to thank the Brookings Institution, University of Bern, and the Liaison Office for their collaborative work on a very timely study on the status of internally displaced persons in Afghanistan. And I'm also thankful to each of the researchers here for your hard efforts and for taking the risk to identify the many challenges facing the internally displaced persons in southern Afghanistan. And, of course, we're grateful to the Norwegian government and other donors for their financial contributions to make this very timely and important study possible. The saga of Afghan refugees and IDPs began in late December 1979. Afghans were an impoverished people, but always content with our agrarian and traditional way of life. Afghans hardly wished to migrate abroad or even become internally displaced for economic opportunities. But, of course, our normal lives abruptly ceased in the days following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And then the ensuing years saw the killing of innocent civilians, destroying their livelihoods, and thus displacing millions of Afghans internally or abroad in search of protection and human security. And more Afghans fled violence, persecution, and ethnic cleansing as a result of regional proxy conflicts in Afghanistan following the fall of the communist regime throughout the 1990s. During this period, many Afghans sought refuge in neighboring Pakistan and Iran, and while those who could not make the trek outside continued to be displaced persons over and over again, and I and my family were displaced too back in early 1990s when, of course, the Soviets withdrew and the communist regime failed and a massive influx of Afghan refugees returned, and then unfortunate regional proxy conflicts began, and then those who could afford went back to Iran and Pakistan, and those who couldn't afford were internally displaced, and we were displaced to northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif and others to Herat and other safer areas. But in the past 3 decades, Afghan refugees and IDPs have never hesitated to return home as soon as conditions for a peaceful life have emerged. Back in 1992 and 1993, for example, as like I just said, after the fall of the communist regime, more than 2 million Afghan refugees voluntarily repatriated from Pakistan and Iran. But their return soon stopped after the breakout of regional proxy conflicts that plunged our country into anarchy and chaos for a decade. And once again, encouraged by international re-engagement in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, more than 5 million Afghan refugees spontaneously returned home from Pakistan and Iran. And we know that this is the single largest voluntary repatriation in the history of UNHCR. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of IDPs returned to their villages of origin, hoping that they would be provided with reintegration assistance to resume or restart their lives. But again, like the period following the fall of the communist regime, Afghans' basic expectations for protection and a very basic livelihood did not materialize. And today, one of the most vulnerable groups of concern, and unfortunately forgotten in Afghanistan, is the internally displaced persons. Last year, UNHCR and our Minister of Refugees and Repatriation identified some 236,000 IDPs across the country. The bulk of this population, about 166,000, was displaced as a result of conflicts and a long drought before and after the fall of the Taliban. Most of these IDPs have settled in temporary camps in the south, southeast, and west of Afghanistan. In addition, there are some 53,000 returnees from Pakistan since 2005, and this was, of course, based on a report that was released last year. That remained displaced in eastern Afghanistan as they were unable to return to their villages of origin when they returned from Pakistan, or because of also a lack of land and a lack of basic services in those areas. In addition, last year, UNHCR and our minister reported that some 10,000 newly displaced people were in Afghanistan because of mostly military operations in the south, in Helmand and Kandahar provinces. And with exception of a few camps in Helmand, Kandahar, Herat, and Mazar-e-Sharif, and with very little assistance, aid organizations have been unwilling or barred by insecurity to provide assistance to the various categories of IDPs that I just discussed. And primarily, one reason that I hear or cited in the reports is that the reason why they, you know, don't maintain camps and provide assistance is because they fear that more poor people and more battle-affected people flock to those camps for assistance, which they think is not there. And we think that this is a legitimate concern, but IDPs said this report, this study recommends must be identified and assisted. I think I will just pass through my notes and say that we are doing our best, the government of Afghanistan, in particular the Minister of Refugees and Repatriation, to reach out those in need, those who are protracted IDPs and those who have been recently displaced and either as a result of natural disasters or, of course, recent conflicts in southern Afghanistan. But the fact is that, of course, first of all, we lack the resources, and second of all, the capacity to deliver these resources to the needy, particularly in conflict areas. But we do look forward to this implementation of the new strategy, which was discussed. And, of course, its main focus on the civilian assistance and, of course, the focus of the military strategy announced by General McChrystal on protecting the civilians, and which, of course, naturally includes the IDPs, who are more, even more vulnerable than other civilians. And we hope that, of course, the recommendations of this study will be fully considered by the Afghan government and, of course, by a multitude of aid organizations in Afghanistan that are all there with good intentions, but unfortunately often bypass one another and definitely bypass the Afghan government. And I can say this from my own experience, having worked with UNHCR and having worked with NGOs, that I think it's the last thing on their mind to contact the Afghan government and to, you know, involve them and to engage them and to, you know, help them build capacity to address some of these issues increasingly on their own. Most of these NGOs are there, of course, with good intentions, and some of them have done good work, and there are some that, of course, we have praised in the past and have been in Afghanistan during even really bad days, but there are a lot of also NGOs that basically perpetuate themselves, right? Proposal after proposal after proposal without necessarily looking at, of course, what the Afghan government has successfully done or what UNHCR has successfully done and how to basically pool our resources and our efforts and so on to, you know, strategically coordinate and to deliver assistance. And I think this has to be, like counter-narcotics, as a policy of all socioeconomic and security and institutions, like my colleague said, because unless we improve security, unless we provide basic services to people, unless we also implement extensive land reforms, and unless, of course, we implement the judicial reform in order to be able to provide land to IDPs, especially the protracted IDPs, to have a piece of land and others to deliver assistance for them to work on that piece of land, it's really hard for them to either locally integrate or resettle, it's another solution, or reintegrate once they return to their home. So it has to be a policy of everything, and it has to be an integrated approach. It has to be a whole-of-government, so to speak, approach, so that we make the impact we all collectively try to make. And of course, there are some of the recommendations that I may disagree with because, like I said, unless everything works, it's really hard to implement some of these recommendations. They're good, but it's always about implementations and the right mechanisms and, of course, the willingness to be coordinated, not only the aid organizations, Afghan government, and, of course, multiple contractors and security institutions. So this is really the challenge, as we move forward in this process. And if we address this challenge, hopefully, then we will be able to implement some of these recommendations to help IDPs. And with that.
Thank you, Ashraf, particularly for emphasizing the importance on implementation and the challenges to implementing these types of recommendations. Before I turn it over to Alex, who will begin walking us through the report, I am glad to see that many of you have picked up copies of the report. Please note that it does say draft on it, on the cover. We did want to release it as soon as possible in this form for today's discussion, but we will be just finalizing it in the next couple weeks and releasing it as a full-blown color glossy report in early January, both in hard copy and electronically. So, sorry for that intervention, but Alex?
No, thanks. I think many of the things that I was going to sort of introduce have already been covered, and I don't want to be repetitive. Let me just explain maybe how this study came about. There's been over the past year or two a slow recognition that internal displacement is on the rise in Afghanistan, but at the same time, very little is known about it. We do have this irony that throughout this year we've been talking about revised military strategies and counterinsurgencies, and yet at the same time very little has been said about the humanitarian consequences of this strategy. To the extent that international aid is mentioned at all, it's usually in the form of development aid or a surge in development activities. But very little on who's being displaced, where, why. So what this study tried to do was maybe focus a little bit of attention on displacement, which in many other places, even in the region, is a natural byproduct of conflict. We certainly saw that this year in Pakistan when the operation started there. You immediately had camps set up, international assistance going in. There was no question that these people would be assisted. But you have a very different situation in Afghanistan, and I think very little discussion about how to assist and who to assist. For many of the reasons that have been mentioned here, there's this fear of creating pull factors of camps that all of the poor would flock to try to get assistance. But it's created this situation where many people who need assistance the most have not had access to it. I think having been on the ground, one of the ironic things there, certainly I went in 2006, was at the same time as we were watching conditions deteriorate on the ground, the return and repatriation operation was still being hailed as one of UNHCR's most successful operations. It was the largest in recent history. I think as of the time of this writing of the report, there was nearly 4.5 million people who had been helped to come home. So while you had sort of this situation falling apart in many parts of the country, aid agencies having less and less access, you still had this focus on post-conflict and people voluntarily coming home. But I think at the same time, over the past couple of years, there has been a renewed focus, certainly that absorption capacity has been pretty well exhausted in Afghanistan. There's been a huge amount of urban migration, and at the same time, there's the worsening conflict in many parts of the countryside has forced people to seek safety in urban areas. And this mix of migratory trends of both economic migration and conflict-affected internal displacement has led to a big argument over whether these people are economic migrants or internally displaced persons. And I think there's an equally fair question that could be asked, should we even try to sort this out at this point? If you look at Kabul alone, I think at the fall of the Taliban, it was maybe 1 million people. Today, it's 5 million people. The entire city is nearly a great big squatter settlement. When I was down in Kandahar, I asked an IDP, we were discussing this whole debate over whether they're economic migrants or internally displaced persons. And he had a very simple answer. He said, economic migrants leave their families at home. If I were an economic migrant, I would not have traveled with my family. In Pashtun culture, it's a huge humiliation for me to bring my family from home and set up a house somewhere else. To expose my family to that kind of danger, I never would have done it. He said, I left because I had no other choice. I think there's this, the issue of military tactics and strategy has tended to focus on civilian casualties and how to win hearts and minds and how to prevent or lessen civilian casualties, which certainly is a valuable thing to be talking about. But very little attention has been focused on issues associated with internal displacement, questions of who is fleeing, why they're going, where are they going, how are they able to survive when they're displaced. The representative of the Secretary General on the Human Rights of IDPs, who's also the co-director of the Brookings Burn Project on Internal Displacement, Walter Kalin, he made a visit to Afghanistan in 2007, and one of his recommendations was that a national profile needed to be created to sort out who is who, and to try to determine a national strategy, to look at durable solutions for some of these cases, what could be done as interim solutions, how are they being protected, how could they better be protected. And I think for those of you who have glanced through the report, admittedly it's long, I think we do take some swipes at the humanitarian community and everybody, but I hope it's in a constructive way. But we do want to point out that since that visit, which was in 2007, I think a lot has been accomplished. The national profile was developed by the National IDP Task Force, and that's where this number of 230,000 IDPs comes from. The cluster approach, which is an interagency collaborative mechanism to be unrolled in IDP emergencies, was rolled out in Afghanistan, I think, in 2008. But I think one of the key criticisms that remains, and certainly we try to bring this out in our report, is that too little was done and too late. To recognize the problem and I would say the scope of the problem, we've heard the number 230,000, which was the number that the National IDP Task Force identified. But the bulk of that was actually protracted caseloads that were well known to UNHCR. It did not contain very much information about new displacement. To the extent that it mentioned new displacement at all, it made a variety of assumptions that I'm not sure what they were based on. So, for instance, I think it identified several tens of thousands of new battle-affected IDPs, but the operational assumption was that these people were displaced for a very short time. So they would flee either preemptively, having gotten word that there was going to be a military engagement in the area, and they would go back 2 weeks later. To its credit, the IDP Task Force in the report noted that they were likely to be seriously challenged on this point. And I think many of our findings shed, I hope, further light on this, because we found there are many reasons why there's short-term displacement, but it was not because they preferred to go right home. In many cases, they had no other option. So when we were looking at what to do and how the Brookings Burn Project could channel or create a research project that would be most helpful to humanitarian agencies on the ground, two things were suggested. One was a profiling of internal displacement in Kabul, and one was to look at Kandahar province. And we chose to look at Kandahar because I think it has the most interesting mixture of IDP caseloads. You have new battle-affected or conflict-induced caseloads. You have a long-standing camp-based population and one of the sites, Zari Dasht, which UNHCR is currently in the process of trying to close. You also have a very large caseload at a border site called Spin Baldock, where most people consider that IDPs chose to locally integrate there. So one of the things we did was we looked at all of these issues on the range of different types of IDPs and look at the process of how decisions were made. It's also one of the historic places in Afghanistan. I'm sure most of you know it's where the Taliban emerged. It's always attracted certain levels of migration from neighboring provinces as well as from in the province itself. Kandahar City is a large historic and economic center of the south. The border crossing Spin Baldock is one of the largest that straddles the border with Pakistan. And I think most of the humanitarian agencies acknowledge that it's one of the places that has the largest IDP populations. But at the same time, because of security and because of access restrictions, it's also a place that where we know very little about. When I arrived in Kandahar, the first stop I went to was UNAMA, the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan. And I went to see the human rights officer who had been there for 6 months. It was an introductory meeting, and I said, well, tell me about, Kandahar. And he said, I was hoping you could tell me. He said, I've been here for 6 months, and I've never left the office. So even though, and it's not his fault, and I'm not trying to diminish the work they're doing, because most of the people there would like to get out, but they're just not able to. Before I went down, one of the leads on the health sector cluster said they were particularly concerned about Kandahar because they were following the incidence of polio outbreaks, and it very closely mirrored the conflict zone, which was a sign that rural health care was not available in most of the province. So the WHO, for instance, was very worried about what was going on there, but didn't know exactly. Let me basically maybe say a few words about the international humanitarian community, because I can speak from my own experience. It's an incredibly difficult place to work. You can barely, in some cases, get out to the field, leave your office. A lot of project implementation is done via remote control. National NGOs or local partners to go inspect projects. I think at various points, I think now is probably one of them, more than half the country is off limits to aid workers. In my former area, Kunduz, which I had full access to pretty much until the time I left in 2008, now it's completely off limits. Most of my former staff have had to move their family into Kunduz City because it's no longer safe for their families to live in the countryside. And this was in the north, which was always comparatively safe compared to the south. So I think it shows you a little bit the deterioration that's happened at least in the last year to 18 months. Humanitarian space has also decreased, and I think a lot of the humanitarian actors find themselves targets of violence. In 2008, nearly 40 aid workers were killed, which is an unheard of number, both national and international. More national, but I don't think that makes it any more of a tragedy. There's a number of reasons for this, and I think hopefully some of them might come out in the Q&A. But I think it has a lot to do with this focus on development assistance and who's doing development and the rise of for-profit development contractors that sort of blurred the lines of impartiality and neutrality and created this perception that aid workers are now fair targets for insurgents. And I think, again, you could dedicate an entire panel to just that very issue. But in terms of displacement, one of the things we found that adversely impacts the IDP situation is that much of the development aid continues to be tied to political objectives. So you do have this huge disparity of development money being spent in the south where there's no access and very little up north. And I think when we were looking at some of the specific caseloads, this gets back to some of the flawed assumptions that we were finding in the course of the study. And let me just mention a couple of them before I turn over to Suzanne. One of the things we looked at was Zaridasht Camp, which is one of the long-standing IDP camps. Long-standing meaning in 2002 or 2003, it was created basically to move people from Spin Baldock. Over the years, UNHCR has facilitated the return of IDPs willing to go home to the north. But when we went up to the north, we found very, very few IDPs, or returned IDPs, because no attention had been paid to reintegrating them. They were basically assisted to go home, and then they were more or less on their own. So where we did find very small pockets of them, they tended to be very vulnerable households. Most of the men had already gone back to the south. Most of them were, if they were able to access their former homes, could access their houses only, not their farmlands. The discrimination against Pashtun families in the north had not lessened at all, so they weren't able to go into the urban centers in the north and find jobs. So what you found was this big migration of IDPs who went back to Kandahar. Only this time they weren't considered IDPs, and they didn't enjoy any of the protections normally associated with internal displacement. And that's another one of our concerns now, is as there are efforts to close down this camp, I don't think there's been a big recognition that these factors are still in play. And many of the IDPs we were talking to view this simply as a final opportunity to cash out of the system. I think each IDP is given $50 basically to hand in their ration card and go back to the north. And when I was interviewing them, I was in Kandahar City, and we went, as some were coming in to register, and I would interview them. I said, well, are you going to go home? And I interviewed, I think, 25 IDPs in Kandahar. I could not find one that actually intended to go back and stay. They all viewed this as an opportunity to cash out. And why did they view this? Because they had been told by the Ministry of Refugees and Repatriation that the camp would be closed. So they had no other option, and they decided basically to take the money and use that to try to find a durable solution for themselves. Some of them may have, in fact, go home. We don't discount that. But I think if you look at what's happened over the years with the past people, it's more than likely that these people will come back and find themselves back in Kandahar. But this time, really, nobody's problem. They won't be registered as IDPs. They'll be off the books of the Ministry of Refugees and Repatriation. They won't be considered persons of UNHCR concern. But in some cases, they may be more vulnerable than before they left. One more example, I think, would be Spin Boldock, where most of the agencies, the humanitarian agencies, long ago considered the internally displaced persons to have been locally integrated. And this was based on the factors when they did the relocation from the border to this camp that was set up. People were given the choice, you either move and we can assist you, or you stay and consider yourself locally integrated. So what we wanted to look at was, to what extent were these people actually locally integrated? And what we found was that the appearance of economic integration made people think, yes, on one hand, they're locally integrated, but on the other hand, they had no political integration. They had no rights. They couldn't vote for the district shura. They were totally dependent on an area strongman who controlled the border. And even though they had managed to buy land, they didn't really have secure land tenure, so they could be thrown off their land at any time they lost the favor of this local strongman. So when we think, I think we saw how you could see that you could consider these people locally integrated, but I think what we found was it was very much a case of partial integration rather than full integration, and that they were still vulnerable and they were still subject to be thrown off the land at any time. So this is why, just getting back to this question of numbers, 230,000 was the number in the national profile, which was a good start. But we found at least that many in Kandahar province alone, which suggests that the problem of internal displacement in Afghanistan is much, much greater in scope than the IDP task force has to date admitted. Let me shift over to Suzanne, who's going to, I think, cover some of the more thematic elements that we came across in the paper.
Thanks. It's hard to follow, and I'm trying to avoid some of the redundancies that we may have in the report by trying to just emphasize some of the issues that came very strongly out in our research. I'll try to make it through this talk without coughing. I've just come out of Kabul, and the winter, we know it's because there's something that what we call the Kabul cough. You know, you get that because of pollution and dust. Now, as the title of the report already says, most of our findings were around limits in protection or gaps in protection. In addition to what Alex so far has pointed out, of course, the main body or the main in charge of protection would be, of course, the Afghan government, you know, because we're talking about internal displacement. It's within the boundaries of the country. And so, of course, there is a responsibility of the Afghan government to protect its people. Now, most of you probably have read or heard about the fact that since 2001, when, you know, we had to rebuild a new state when the Taliban were thrown out of the country. Of course, there hasn't been made as much progress as probably both Afghans as well as international actors would have hoped to do so. So far, the central government still lacks a lot of capacity as the extremely limited region, rural areas, which is increasingly diminishing, of course, due to insecurity. The rule of law is very weak, and many of the government institutions are still very ineffective and also particularly little trusted by the majority of the Afghan people. Most of the IDPs interviewed expressed little confidence in the ability of the government to deliver services and protection. And particularly the National Security Forces, which potentially, as Keith mentioned, didn't receive as much attention as international military actors, are not so much seen as protectors. I would have to say there's a big distinction, however, between the Afghan National Army, which usually has a fairly good reputation but is still very limited in numbers to actually do protection abilities, and the Afghan National Police, which also has limited numbers but also has an incredibly bad reputation, is actually seen more as a perpetrator than a protector, and that, of course, is what usually civilian population have closest connection to. I always like to make a reference to a report by Andrew Wilder for the Afghan Research and Evaluation Unit called Cops and Robbers, which kind of sums it up very nicely, how the police is seen in Afghanistan. And I think most international actors are quite aware that there's a lot of capacity building needed in that area of the policing, and I think the Afghan government is aware of that as well. So probably in the protection, you know, aside from the fact, and I don't think I want to go in so much with the weakness of the Afghan government, is that there are two benchmarks which are really not reached by the Afghan government yet in terms of national responsibility. And one is, of course, the allocation of adequate resources to address displacement. As most of you know, the Afghan state is still heavily dependent on external contributions and funding, so obviously it lacks money and would always have to lobby with donors about money that it needs for any programs, including, you know, to address internal displacement. And that, in our discussions with the Ministry of Refugees and Repatriation, came out very strongly. They say, of course, we're willing to assist. However, it would need the assistance of the international community to do so. And the second one is the requirement that the ability to prevent displacement, and because the Afghan government has a certain weakness, is unable to rein in on the insurgency, there's a bit of a problem to actually prevent causes of displacement, you know. But it's not just the insurgency that has got problems with it. It's also very difficult to rein into international forces. I mean, there have been many calls from President Karzai to curb aerial bombardment with not as much effect as he probably would have liked, so about that entire issue. So the government as such there has also limited capacity, which by many IDPs interviewed for the study came also out that they feel that their government is not fully sovereign in that sense vis-a-vis the international forces, that somehow can do things as they please without necessarily always the consent of the Afghan government. I think that's an important issue when we look at how international military that comes in an intervention and then becomes a supportive force could be potentially seen slightly differently, not so much as working into supporting national responsibility to protect individuals, but potentially seeing as undermining it. And I think there's an issue that as we look into our military strategy, the revisions is we have to really come to grasp with, because, and that's probably why in the report international military maybe received a bit more attention, is because it's talking about us. It's about our side and our own responsibility. We're not a neutral actor anymore, yes, as humanitarian action would usually be, because we have also military in Afghanistan. We are party to the conflict. And I think that's something that maybe hasn't been addressed as much as it probably should have. The interesting thing is that many IDPs even see the country run by the Americans and not the Afghan government, particularly in the South. You know, there's a lot of people, when you interview them, that come out with that. And the newest thing we hear is that they make a distinction between the bearded Americans and the not-bearded Americans. And that, for me, shows also when you look at two military action, is it two different mandates in Afghanistan that we need to come to terms with. That on the one hand, you have ISAF, NATO, which are there to support the Afghan government for security and development, you know, and reconstruction. And then you still have Operation Enduring Freedom and Special Forces operating, which is essentially to encounter terrorism. And those two different mandates really clash, and you can see it on the ground. And the way, I describe it is that local population, now say there's bearded Americans who behave extremely badly, and then there's shaven Americans who behave a bit better in the entire issue. Now, given that those different mandates or different actors in Afghanistan, and even within ISF NATO, you have different nations, which, yes, I mean, they try to consolidate, but still you have lead nations. In Kandahar, it's the Canadians. In Uruzgan, it's the Dutch. In Helmand, it's the British. You know, in Zabul, it's the Americans, when we talk about the South. So the whole issue of protection remains still very vague in Afghanistan, I would argue, among those actors. And it's very open to interpretation, you know. So maybe one actor interprets protection slightly differently than that. I don't think there's a uniform interpretation of what protection really entails and whether or not displacement is actually part of protection. Civilian casualties has received a lot of attention because a lot of pressure has been put on the military actors there to be aware of civilian casualties. But when I did a lot of the interviews with the military, it was interesting that some of the first answers I've got was, oh, displacement, that's not really our mandate. And then when I kept pushing up and said, well, your mandate is security, wouldn't displacement be part of that? Then they conceded that, yes, indeed, you know, displacement was part of security. But a lot of people said, well, we're not experience, you know, most soldiers would not know an IDP when they run across one on the ground. They wouldn't be able to identify it, which is probably why recently 2,000 more displaced in Helmand were identified by the Afghan Red Crescent Society, but the military says there weren't any, you know, or at least not displaced by their activities. So there's the whole issue of being able to identify displacement and being able to link one's own kinetic or whatever activities to displacement as it happens, you know, because we're there to protect, we're there to secure, we're there to clear areas, you know, we're certainly not there to displace people, yet it does seem to happen. And in my conversation with military, I don't think it has really been fully thought through as part of the strategies. Most of the COIN strategies talk about behavior towards the local population. They talk about, again, civilian casualties. They don't explicitly talk about displacement, you know, because when I was asked, I was told, oh, it's in our strategies. And when I asked for a copy and I finally got the copy, there was really nothing explicitly about displacement in there. You would have to read between the lines about it. And I think that if I have to read between the lines, it might be extremely difficult for soldiers to read between the lines if they're not sensitized to the issue to begin with. And if they are, as according to an ISAF rep I spoke to, wouldn't even know an IDP if they saw one, you know. And as he also emphasized, lack even the reach in the country to be able to cover everything and understand it. So I think that's a big issue, I think, in terms of protection where we need to deal with. And there's also the question, even though McChrystal make protection of Afghans as one of the key now for the engagement in Afghanistan, whether or not the military actually even knows how to do protection, whether they even understand what civilian protection means, whether there's a lot more to be done. And I've actually discussed it with military, and some believe that a lot more learning needs to be done within the military itself, what it means to protect civilians on the ground. Now, and the other thing, I think, which is in addition that you don't understand displacement, I think there's a bit of a difficulty to understand the causes of displacement as well, and how much people on the ground are really caught between a rock and a hard place. Because they're extremely complex push factors. The reason why we don't use the term battle-affected displacement anymore in our report, and UNHCR also doesn't use the report in their strategy anymore, that term, is because it's not simply IDPs fleeing from actual battle. I mean, there is this flawed assumption that when the bombs begin falling or when they're kinetic, I love this word, kinetic activities, I learned it through this report, kinetic activities in an area, then people flee. But it's actually far more complex because it's also for a civilian to live in extremely uncertain situations, in a situation with very limited predictability, where there's harassment, where they're caught between the different warring parties, and where there seems to be a lack of understanding of who is an insurgent, who's not an insurgent, who's actually really the enemy. And the civilians are really just caught in the middle. So the question is, are you going to leave yourself in that situation, or are you going to take yourself out of the situation? So people do flee actually fighting, but people also flee preemptively, or they flee harassment. There was one IDP who said, I fled to keep my dignity because of house searches, for example, because we're so tired of having people come to the houses. And the problem is that it may not just be one person who comes. It's often that one night the Taliban comes and then asks for food and accommodation, and then if nobody protects you, what are you going to do as a civilian? Likely you will have to accommodate the Taliban and give them food, because you know that if you don't, you might be killed. And then if you're very unlucky, immediately next night, then the Afghan government and the international forces come and say, well, who were the Taliban? What did they want? Why did you help them? Are you part of them, etc.? And if you really, and then potentially, if you're really unlucky, you're brought then to prison. If you were lucky, you might be staying at home, and then the next night the Taliban may come again and say, "Oh, what did the government want?" So, and in the words of one IDP, he says, "We are caught in the middle of all of them. If you side with the government, the Taliban will kill you. If you side with the Taliban, the government will take you, and the bombs will fall. So, what do you really do as a civilian?" So, and that brings us to the coping strategies. You know, what do people do in an environment where there's a lack of protection, but where there's a lot of threats actually coming from multiple sides? You take yourself out of it. And that's the interesting, a lot of debate how to put that in the report, because one of the primary identification that every IDP interviewed said that flight was their primary coping strategy. It's kind of really funny to say if that's a coping strategy for IDPs, because after displacement, but people actually saw the ability to be able to put themselves out of danger as the primary coping strategy, to put their family and themselves into a secure environment, because it's all relative in Afghanistan right now, security. I can't say they put themselves in complete security, because Kandahar is no longer that secure either. But the areas where there's a high concentration of IDPs, which is Kandahar City and Spinboldak, are among the three secure areas in Kandahar still, where the government still has a fair amount of reach, so although that's also diminishing. So despite the loss of property, despite the loss of livelihood, despite the loss of life in the course of flight or of everything, they saw themselves, this was actually a successful way to stay alive. I think that's one thing Afghans are very good at, is to survive and stay alive. So you put yourself out. And that reinforces again what Alex mentioned, that there's a class effect going on. It's essentially only the people with money that can afford to flee. Because you have to have the ability to finance the route into exile. You have to have the ability, because there are no camps you can go to where you receive assistance, you have to have the ability to rent houses unless you have relatives to go somewhere. So it's essentially that, again, is the poorest of the poor have to stay where they are, and they then in turn will have to accommodate themselves with an insecure situation and have to make choices. We always say there are three choices an IDP can do. You flee, you stay, or you join the insurgency, I suppose. So that would be the third choice. So there's not that many choices that people really have anymore in Afghanistan and situation. So now, once you fled, where do you go? And there's essentially, okay, let me backtrack actually, you know, maybe before I say where they go, the assumption of short-term displacement, as Alex already said, is flawed. People don't just leave and go back when the bombing has stopped, because that might be rather silly, actually, because why would you go back to an area where potentially insurgency is there? Why would you go back to an area where the international community is not able to actually protect you still? Even now in Helmand, where areas are cleared, the Taliban is still able to kill pro-government civilians, they consider pro-government, because you will never have enough military in an area to protect actually civilians as much. So usually in those areas, it's not secure anywhere. So why would you actually go back there if you could be associated with either be pro-government or if the Taliban could come back? So actually, it is no longer short-term. It's only the poor people who cannot afford to go elsewhere with short-term. Most other people have already made their choice to be actually displaced long time. Some people have started to buy land and houses because they, in the next future, for the next three years, they're actually proactively seeing that they will not be able to return home because they just don't see this change going on in the areas. So this short-term displacement, you have to get away from the fact that it's a bit wishful thinking. It's easiest for us to assume people just always go home and the problem is over. It is not that case. People are making long-term choices. And that's why they're making very careful choices of where they're fleeing to. If it was short-term, you didn't have to think so much about it. But if you know that it's long-term, you have to go somewhere where you know that you have a place to stay, you will have a livelihood, and you will have a relative security. And that's why Kandahar is a place where many people are going. And there are the rational choices, very rational, just like economic migrants. But we know that already a long time that also forced displacement, that those people make the same rational choices as economic migrants. And doesn't mean they're economic migrants just because they make a choice. So we view that there are pull factors that impact the directionality of the movement where people go. It's not the reason why they leave. There are clear push factors, but there is influences where people go. So whether or not there would be camps or not, people go there because, A, Spinbuldak is an enclave. There are already many displaced populations. According to our estimates, 50% of the population in that particular district is displaced. You could go into the definition game, what does it mean to be an IDP, because some of them have been there 10 years, you know. But as Alex mentioned, they're economically integrated. They lack political integration. So according to the guiding principles, they remain displaced because it's not a durable solution. So you have that? Okay, I'll wrap it up. So you have the choices where they're going, and I'm going to say, and you have enclaves that reduces the risk of flight, and the richer people go to Kandahar City where there are more services but also more expensive houses. And but it's, anyway, the second is family networks are extremely crucial. It decreases the cost of migration. It's a very important information source about the areas of exile, but also you keep in touch with the areas of origin where it is. They're quite well connected. You have ability of a family member staying home to take care of your property while the rest of the family flees. What we've seen is if you have a family needs a male family member to take care of them. So if you don't have that male family member, you have a reduced ability to flee where you go, because if the male needs to go to work, you need to have another male person to stay at home, usually with the family. So that's one. One of the negative coping strategy of families that we've seen a lot of child labor and a lot of underage marriages going on because of IDPs. They lack assistance, they lack money, so they have income generation strategies of sending kids to work and marrying their wives off, their children, their daughters off very, very young for that. So one of the most problematic coping strategies is that they're seeking protection from strongmen and insurgency, and that's very, very dangerous because it increases the vulnerability of IDPs. There's no government protection, there's no international protection, so they seek protection from whoever is willing to provide it. So we see strongman Abdul Razik in Spinbuldak is providing protection. He's the border police commander, so he's essentially government, but he also runs a little sideshow in that area. And IDPs have become his constituency. He's protecting them. He's giving them land. He involves them a bit in his smuggling business. However, at the same time, you know, they are providing him with more, you know, votes and willingness to do support him in other things. So example why this is dangerous, in another area we looked at, which was Sarayadasht, there was a strongman that supported the IDP community initially. The moment he withdrew support and then later was killed, local integration was off the table. It wasn't discussed anymore because at that point the host community said, okay, well, your protector is gone, so we might as well just kick you out. And that is very much linked why now there's a strong push to close the camp down, because the host population wants that land, you know. So it's very dangerous. And the worst is when the insurgency becomes your protector, because there it comes to issue what makes an insurgent. We've seen in Sarayadasht, as they've lost the protector, now the insurgency is starting to infiltrate the camp and starting to recruit among the IDPs. And if you really have nobody to protect you, potentially you are going to accommodate the insurgency. And that also happens for the people that remain, that are unable to flee. They have to accommodate somehow to stay alive. If you can't flee, you have to somehow work your way out. And the problem is then that ultimately, if displaced people are seen as insurgents, just because they have no choice. And that's the important thing. And with the representation, as Alex mentioned, there's a lack of political integration, a lack of the ability to access national development funds. IDPs have tried to address it by creating their own shuras. So we have identified shuras, but they're still rather weak because it's, of course, their own community. They will need more support from the Afghan government to be actually somewhat linked to the political process. And so far, they function a bit more as an internal conflict resolution mechanism. So a lot more work is to be done. And sorry for going a bit over time.
Okay. Okay, well, we have 25 minutes for Q&A, and I do hope we can get a good discussion going. So I would like to invite the audience to ask questions. When you do, please identify to whom you wish to address your question, and also please identify yourself with a brief affiliation if you have one. So we can start in the back. I hope there's mics in the back. There's a gentleman raising his hand, standing up.
Thank you, Raghuveer Goyal, for India Globe and Asia Today. So much has been going on as far as Afghanistan is concerned, so many think tanks and also new policy from the Obama administration and the generals on the ground. Now, what they're all saying that engagement with the people of Afghanistan is most important and must without engaging the people. But you're saying that government has failed to protect the people, but Talibans are there to protect them. So what message do you have for the NATO and for the Obama administration, especially the U.S. forces going there, more than 30,000 plus 10,000 from the NATO? So where do we go from here, and is there enough money for the people of Afghanistan compared with the people of Pakistan?
Any volunteers?
We'll start individually, and then we can collect some at the end. But,
I think I heard kind of criticism of the Afghan government, and I think I agree to the extent that we have not tried. But, of course, our efforts depend on resources and efforts, especially coordinated efforts from the international community. And you also have to look at the amount of funding or resources given to civilian causes. If you compare from 2001 until 2008, and then, of course, even now, you see that the military operations get always 80% of all assistance of here in the United States or even Europe, mostly spent on their own military operations in Afghanistan. About 20% is given to civilian causes, and of that 20%, about only a fraction of that actually goes to the Afghan government. The rest is, you know, gone to the donor-related NGOs and contractors and subcontractors. And we also know the story about contracting and subcontracting, and also the story of these very costly, in terms, unfortunately, family of United Nations with huge overhead costs. We know about their, you know, Land Cruisers I used to drive in those, and I also know about the salaries of the international staff of the United Nations. You really have to look at, you know, where the resources are coming, how those resources are allocated, how much of that resource goes to the military operations, how much of that, you know, resource is spent by, you know, the military of those 40-plus countries in Afghanistan, including the United States, and then, of course, 20% civilian resources, how that gets allocated and how that's channeled to Afghanistan. And are now, this is not what I make up as a government official, these are reports written by NGOs, by think tanks, some of perhaps including Brookings Institution, on aid effectiveness in Afghanistan. Unless we ensure aid effectiveness, unless, as I said, through, of course, allocation and delivery mechanisms, and increasingly, of course, that has been our demand from the very beginning, please help us build capacity for absorbing aid. But if we continue to say that the Afghan government doesn't have absorptive capacity and therefore we rely on NGOs and contractors, there will be no state in Afghanistan. We started from zero stateness in Afghanistan. There was no state when we reengaged in Afghanistan. The state was gone. It had collapsed. And then we stood up a parallel institution side by side the Afghan government. A weak, resourceless government on the paper versus 42-plus countries, plus their NGOs, plus their contractors, plus, of course, the United Nations and its families. That's how, unfortunately, the resources have been diverted and wasted so far, and that's why the Afghan government is today remained weak or absent. It's not even about weakness, about our failure, but also about our absence. We are not present in the first place, including in the provinces that were mentioned. In Kandahar, we have very limited presence and access. In Helmand, very limited presence and access of both our security institutions, the police. As much as our police are called corrupt, that we are losing three police every day, far more than Afghan National Army, far more definitely of NATO, ISAF, and U.S. forces. And as well as our judicial system, which is in shambles, unfortunately, because the Italians did nothing to really, even to jump start it in Kabul, let alone, you know, extend it to the provincial level and down to the local level. So we're talking about a state building from ground up, 8 years on. That has not happened, that needs to happen, and that's what the government of Afghanistan, the leadership of Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai, is committed to working with the international community in a joint, equal partnership to work together to get this right, because it's not only about our survival, the survival of the Afghan people, our IDPs, our refugees, but also it is about the security of the United States and the security of NATO. Thank you.
The one thing I want to, like, we're not saying that the Taliban is necessarily just protecting. We're saying that in the absence of protection, the Taliban may step in, but it comes at a cost for the displaced population, because they obviously want something in return, which is that you're being recruited into their ranks, whether or not your ideology is supported or not. So I think it's very dangerous. I just want to emphasize that that's not exactly what the report says, so I don't want to have that misunderstanding there. And for me, the call for the international actors is to support the Afghan government to make sure that they are not undermining national protection responsibilities, and that they are able to potentially, like, reconsider their counterinsurgency strategies on the ground as they're contributing to the conflict and displacement.
So. Perhaps we can move the mic up just a little bit. I see a question here in the middle, this gentleman. Then we can go here in the front.
Yes, Anthony Skirbo. I'm an independent analyst. Following up on the last comment, with the administration's new strategy of inserting a great deal more troops and other international military actors adding additional troops as well, tying into the strategy of clear, hold, and build, if the Afghan government is the primary actor in terms of dealing with the IDP problem, how can the international military community either change or introduce a new dynamic in making a positive contribution toward building security for the IDPs, and additionally either replacing or restating the role of the camps, temporary locations, things like that? And that's for anyone on the panel.
Susanna.
Restating? Was it replacing the camps?
To decongest the camps and to close the camps.
Either to create new secure locations and get people moved back into their communities where they want to be and they belong, or to eliminate those areas where they're not secure and they're either being coaxed into leaving or constantly dealing with the revolving door of international military, then the Taliban, then the Afghans, then the Taliban, etc.
Do you want to address the issue of the role of international military?
It's difficult. I mean, if you'd ask me, I'd say stop doing house searches, you know, stop picking up people and putting them into Bagram, you know, so where maybe like half the time when they come out, they rejoin the insurgency because they're angry or something. So, I mean, I just think, you know, there are reasons why we have certain conventions, there are reasons why there are certain international human rights, and I think they're just not being as respected as they could be. And I think that's what I mean by relooking at the counterinsurgency strategy. I mean, you have to really understand, are you contributing indirectly to the insurgency or really, you know, countering in that? I would probably also try to limit aerial bombardments, because in a context like Afghanistan, there's a high likelihood you're going to hit civilians, you know. So, and if you know that undermines your own strategy. So it's just, I think it's just a very, very difficult, you know, and the different philosophies and how you can do that. And I think there's just, in my opinion, a lot more thinking needs to be done, whether we're continuing with the aggressive stance we've had or whether we're looking into different options of how to deal with the problem of the insurgency in Afghanistan. Because, I mean, frankly, with the more troops being put, and I heard 10,000 of them will go into Kandahar, it's not looking so good. It's not going to look so good of how things are going. Look at Helmand, how people have been displaced from the kinetic activities there. I think, you know, in your clear hold build, I've heard there's a shape part as well, you will always displace people. And I think just nobody really is prepared on how to do that. I'm not so sure how much the military really has a role in protecting camps, you know, because it's a civil military issue for me. I mean, there are certain areas where it already exists. In Spin Bulldog, actually, there is access by the Afghan Red Crescent Societies. Local organizations have access. Parts of Afghan government have access. So for me, it's just more supporting what there already is all, as Mr. Haideri said, often as they're lacking is that there's an acknowledgement of the problem, that we understand the needs of the population and that money is provided to assist them. But first of all, you need to acknowledge it. And right now, if you look any numbers, there's no acknowledgement of IDPs in Spinbuldak whatsoever, and hardly in Kandahar City. So, I mean, first of all, you need to do a profiling and understand the population, and I think then it's possible to assist them. And I'm not necessarily thinking that military needs to do that in those areas because it is secure enough. Otherwise, the IDPs would not have gone there. In the areas, in the field where they're getting displaced, I'm not so sure whether it's a military role to actually provide assistance, probably the military to provide the secure area and then let the humanitarians come and do the assistance. Because the more you're associated with a party of the conflict, that decreases the security of the civilians again. That's what I'd like to repeat, because everybody's seen pro-military and pro-government in some of the areas is still likely to be killed. And we have to understand that, and we can't get around it. And frankly, I don't think that you can get as many soldiers as it's needed on the ground to have a military protection. That's why we need to change our thinking and strategy.
Ashraf, you wanted to...
I think we also need to listen to the Afghan people, what they really demand. We need to look at the polls. There have been so many polls recently conducted in Afghanistan. And when you ask any Afghan, the first word that you hear is amniyat, security. Give me amniyat, give me security. Of course, the rest we will take care of. Afghans are resilient. We have survived for the past 30 years. Even before the Soviet invasion, the government was weak and very limited to Kabul and provincial centers. People were pretty much on their own. Very resilient, very enterprising. It's my generation, about 30 years of age, that is constituting some more than 60% of the Afghan population. We have a large refugee population in Iran and Pakistan. We have a large diaspora in the West and the developed countries. We're in touch. We're supporting one another. But, of course, we need to focus on security as much as we can. Where we, of course, there is security, and especially in North News, Alex pointed out, we need to provide assistance to people there. We need to create on-form and off-form job opportunities there. Of course, job opportunities, the second demand of the Afghan people. When you ask them, what do you need for security? And then second is a job. Give me a livelihood. So you don't have to do it in the middle of hellmand, getting people caught, you know, in the fire. But people, of course, Afghans are very rational. They listen to radio. They're very politically savvy. If they know there is assistance going on, there are job opportunities in northern Afghanistan, northeast of Afghanistan, western Afghanistan, they will go there. They will just get displaced and go there, just like my family and I did. We left Kabul. We didn't go to Pakistan. We went to Mazar-Sharif because my father knew as a pharmacist he could get a job, and he did. And that's how we survived for the next, you know, decade until, you know, the Taliban ethnically cleansed Mazar. So Afghans know the country well. They have traveled extensively. Political integration, I think, are of course a concern, but it's not a priority. But really what people care first and foremost is basic security, that his family, his members of his family are safe. And then secondly, a livelihood to just make both ends meet. But the rest will, of course, take place. But if we really focus on these issues, the basics of what the Afghan people demand, not so much about, you know, human rights, great.
Yes.
You know, who doesn't want human rights? Who doesn't want democracy? But realistically, given the conditions in Afghanistan, given this divided alliance so far, unfortunately, given the, you know, multitude of, you know, rules of engagement and the debate that is ongoing here, we need to do what the Afghan people demand, the basics, and they always demand the basics. And, of course, empower the Afghan government as much as we can, and basically applying the principle of do no harm, by which I mean creating capacity in the Afghan government every day, as much as we can. If you're an NGO, if you're a UN agency, if you're a contractor, if you're a government with, like, USAID there, to help the Afghan government gain capacity and provide it with the resources to implement those, you know, resources on their own, so the people see that the government is, you know, gaining capacity and is providing them with basic services, and so that we over time become self-reliant. I think I always see IDP and a refugee as a whole of government approach. Without the government working and delivering integrated assistance, you cannot solve IDP problem. You can talk about it, you can make recommendations, you can talk about human rights, and there's so many details that these big reports cover, but unless we do that, unless we really enable the Afghan government and coordinate, like I said in the beginning, and really listen to the Afghan people and deliver on the very basic expectations of the Afghan people and be innovative in the way you deliver assistance to the Afghan people, it's really hard to resolve it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have one question here, and then we'll make our way back. Please identify yourself. And
thanks, yes. Patrick Duplain from Refugees International. I'm sure you've had a healthy debate in Kabul with UNHCR about who is an IDP and, you know, the caseload, et cetera. And I was wondering, why do you think there's a reluctance to acknowledge the problem as you've defined it? And second, Alex, you've talked about the decreasing humanitarian space, humanitarian actors, humanitarian funding. How do we get NGOs, both Afghans and international, to respond to the IDP problems? Mm-hmm. And lastly, I just wanted to know if you could comment on the role of PRTs in responding to the IDP situation. Thank you.
We did have a very healthy exchange with UNHCR. My impression is that for a long time they wanted to keep the IDP problem manageable. In the context of, I think for too long, most of the humanitarian agencies, the big agencies, wanted to keep a bit of positive momentum in a bit of this post-conflict mentality. And I think they were also supported across the board by the donors in this. It's a tricky one because I don't think UNHCR in Afghanistan is monolithic. We heard different views from across the board, from protection officers, from senior managers who all thought different things. I don't question their intentions, but I think there are some basic issues that haven't been addressed. And as Suzanne said, I think one of the things is you have to acknowledge the scope of the problem because you can't begin to find solutions unless you're willing to acknowledge the breadth of the problem and that people do, you know, have valid reasons for fleeing. Even in terms of the economic migrants, the economic disruptions are so severe in the rural countryside because of the conflict. They can no longer access services. They can no longer send their children to school. There's no livelihoods left except for probably poppy cultivation. That a lot of people don't have choices that are much more indirectly related to the conflict. When we did talk, we did have some discussions with UNHCR, and I think they raised the very good question of, well, is it helpful to separate or try to distinguish IDPs from the larger urban poor? And it's a very fair question, because possibly, especially for a place like Kabul, what you need is an urban poverty strategy, not trying to distinguish one group that would create pull factors and create competition among the most vulnerable. I'm not sure that thinking can be extrapolated to places like Kandahar, where you have a much more manageable and easily identifiable caseloads of people who are in trouble. And like the report points out, this class effect is really disturbing in the fact that that the poorest of the poor, who need the help the most, don't make the choice to seek safety because there is no humanitarian assistance and they simply can't survive. So they do make the difficult choice to stay there and make whatever compromises they make to survive. On the question of restoring humanitarian space, I've asked myself this 1,000 times, and I don't know the answer. And I think it relates a little bit to the last question where we're saying, oh, you know, the government has to do this, the aid committee has to do this. I think we have to acknowledge that we've done a pretty poor job across the board. I think the government has done a miserable job in many cases. I think the aid community has been, in many cases, disastrous. And like I said, I fully, having partaken of one of those high salaries, he meant I'm plagued with guilt about it. but it is a problem, and I don't know the answer. And I think the huge influx of for-profit development contractors is a big part of the problem. They'll go anywhere for the right amount of money. They have ruined it for the traditional NGOs. I had so many discussions with traditional NGOs who focus on process and peaceful coexistence and peace building, and the process is important, not so much the quarter of a million dollar new school that where there's no teachers, off in the middle of nowhere. So I think there's not a lot of patience for the process of development. And I think development for the sake of development really works. But in most places in Afghanistan, it's not development for the sake of development. It's development for the sake of a political objective that in many cases is not very popular. So, short of burning down the house and starting over again, I think each sector has to take a very hard look at what they're doing. And see how they can recreate and move forward. But it won't be an easy challenge. And I think even with this, the counterinsurgency strategy of clear, hold, and build, there's a huge role for development actors in there. But given the restriction that most of the NGOs now face, I don't know how you fill that void quickly enough, because most of the development actors, with good reason, can no longer move. So that's not an answer, but...
On the PRT, I don't know. Keith, do you want to get in on that one, or
On the PRTs?
Yeah, or any.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the problems with PRTs is that the nations who have lead nation responsibility tend to channel funding to their own PRTs in order to get, for various reasons, but mostly for political reasons, to get results in the province where they operate. And it sort of comes back to the point which was raised earlier, that from the Norwegian point of view, we believe that we need to make the Afghan authorities able to solve the IDP problem. We need to build their capacity. Norwegian civilian aid, which is about $150 million a year, 75% of that goes to the government in Kabul. Less than 20% goes to Faryab, where we have our PRT. And the idea then is that the Afghan authorities need to prioritize and do the development projects after Afghan priorities, not after Norwegian priorities. And that looks good on paper. Obviously, there are problems, and we have a long way to go, but I do think that that is where we all should be looking at going. There's a lot of talk about the international community has to do this, or the UNHCR needs to do this, but in fact, we should all be thinking about how we can make Afghan authorities available to do the job, because it is, at the end of the day, we need to make this a truly Afghan project.
Okay, we only have a couple more minutes. I do want to just give people an opportunity. We have one question here. Could you just ask your question briefly? We'll take three more. One here, right here up front, and then I think this woman in the middle, and then the woman in the back. So just very briefly.
Hi, I'm Diane Paul. I had a question about how to decrease the recruitment capacity of the Taliban through, I guess what you might say, protection activities related to protecting the civilians in terms of protecting them from recruitment efforts. If you could speak a little bit to that, and whether the military is at all whether there's any concept about that, about how to protect civilians and how to create, and it relates again to creating humanitarian space, but to protecting people from that that pressure to participate in the Taliban activities.
Just gather them all, and then we'll answer them. Okay. Just a little bit in the middle here, and then in all the way in the back, and then we'll wrap up.
Thank you. First of all, I would say thank you to the very important report that you guys presented today and for a very good presentation. I'm Palwasha Hassan. I'm Afghan fellow at U.S. Institute of Peace. My question is regarding the Afghan policy debate in United States, and especially the President Obama's talk on Afghanistan showed that that U.S. will be working in Afghanistan more like in a decentralized way, with governors and ministers who are perceived to be good and like probably some of the provinces in the north will be considered that way. For instance, Mazar doesn't have that much instability on the surface, but there is a lot of issues like for the minorities and people who, and that's sort of like, I'm afraid, will be consolidation of the warlords and people who has committed atrocities. Maybe overall it looks like a stable and secure provinces, but not everybody is secure there. And IDP problem is one of the reasons that there should be attention for this kind of strategy in Afghanistan. So I would like any of the panelists if could comment on this U.S. strategy in Afghanistan working in a decentralized way and probably working with warlords and continuous support of the U.S. to them.
Okay. And then one final question, please, very briefly.
Hi, Laura Eom. I'm a freelance reporter for 51%. It's a women's radio program. Wondering how many women or females are involved in the IDP, how many, what your estimate is for the statistics, and also whether any cultural constraints also may be affecting whether or not they have access to aid or to any of these other programs. I understand that there are some cultural constraints that women, for example, going to secondary school, there are constraints. They can't walk alone to the schools. They can get harassed or come under criticism within their own families about doing these sorts of things. So are there these cultural constraints that also prevent women from getting access to some of the programs that may be available for IDPs?
Okay, thank you very much. So we have a question on, I believe, recruitment capacity and protection issues, and then working with local officials and the role of strongmen and warlords, and then the issues of demographics, how many women IDPs there are and their specific vulnerabilities and situations. So on the protection and recruitment issue, which is sort of referred to in the report in terms of a vulnerability, anything?
Should we get all the questions?
We'll just do it that. We'll just go one by one.
Okay. I mean, Most Afghan civilians, if you give them the choice, if there was a choice of who to protect them, they would choose the Afghan government. They would not choose the insurgency. So, yes, increased protection would decrease the recruitment potential of the insurgency. Because, frankly speaking, when people accommodate the Taliban, it's often not by choice. It's not because they ideologically support the Taliban. It's because of lack of choices. So I think the moment we increase those choices and we increase the capacity, and if you ask Afghans, they would like to have an increase of the Afghan National Army. They would like to have a better ANP, and they would like to have the Afghan government to have an increased capacity to provide the services that you would expect from government. Above and beyond, to put more money into putting more soldiers in the country. Most Afghans would have said, why you waste money on 30,000 foreign soldiers? Why don't you use that money to increase the capacity of the ANA and the ANP? Because likely they're cheaper, more effective, and they're there to stay. It's more sustainable. And again, it is they understand the localities a bit better. So that's what you see. So if you increase that protection, yes, we will decrease the recruitment potential of the insurgency. And with the fact that the insurgency banks right now on an anti-Western propaganda as well, it becomes more dangerous to have more international forces in the country. That's why it's actually better if it's Afghan forces who would fight the insurgency than international forces, because the moment you do with international, they can have this invader art rationale they're using in their propaganda. If it was Afghans fighting the insurgency, you cannot use it anymore. So that on the recruitment part.
I think there are two types of protection. One is, of course, protective security, and then human security. Human security, protective security. And Afghans need both. of course, protective security when, of course, we help the Afghan security institutions, the Afghan National Army and the police build capacity, get equipped and deployed, and hopefully to replace increasingly from this point on to provide security for the people. The Afghan National Army is widely accepted and praised by the Afghan people, as well as the police, as much as we, of course, complain about the police. But if you look at the recent polls, especially the one by the Asia Foundation, the Afghan people, 60% approve of the police performance, about above, I think, 85% of the Afghan army. And of the overall Afghan government, about 70%. Unfortunately, the Afghan government has not been good at to look at these, you know, polls and really, you know, share this with the public inside of Afghanistan and, with, of course, the broader public in Europe and the United States. And then, of course, on human security, of what the Afghan government has done a good job in terms of providing increased access to education, to healthcare, to as well as also development on the local level through National Solidarity Program, which is now reaching over 20,000 villages across Afghanistan, which is one of the best mechanisms in terms of providing, you know, assistance to IDPs or in terms of helping PRTs to do sustainable work on the local level, which unfortunately they are not. So the institutions are there. There are some best performing institutions, some best mechanisms in place, and best national programs in place, such as I said, National Solidarity Program, National Area-Based Development Program, jointly run with UNDP, and other such programs. But the fact is that a lot of, you know, non-Afghan entities bypass these, try to come up with parallel institutions. And I could name a few in the U.S. government that have to be just rolled down and their resources channeled into the programs and institutions and the Afghan government that actually operate. For example, our Minister of Rural Rehabilitation and Development has an absorptive capacity of over $350 million a year. And they can absorb more. I had a good meeting with our minister just recently, and they're trying to even tap into the SERP funding, $1 billion a year. Imagine that. Of course, now we have a very good minister within the Ministry of Agriculture. He's working on a national strategy. He's getting more funding and expecting to get more resources to implement, you know, a national strategy to help revitalize the agriculture sector, so there will be jobs for many of these IDPs. So if we ensure the two and provide the requisite resources and coordinate across the government and within ourselves, the international community, our, you know, profit sector, non-for-profit, and the military, then I think we will go a long way. And really, I mean, 3 to 5 years, as President Karzai said in his inaugural speech, is realistic if everything works. And also, it's important that we have been in Afghanistan for the past 8 years. We have learned by doing things. And there are many lessons learned, if it is in, you know, refugee reintegration, internal displacement, if it is in security sector. There are many good lessons learned that we need to exploit and capitalize on.
I'm sorry, I'm really hesitant to cut this off, but we have run over. Thank you for your patience. Suzanne has agreed to just field the last question on the role of women and their particular vulnerabilities and cultural sensitivities, and then we'll close.
I mean, numbers is really hard because you would need a proper profile, but I would say what holds for most displaced populations, you know, that's at least a minimum of 50% and maybe even upwards, it's going to be, if you include children, it's going to be higher than that, you know, because obviously over 50% of the population is underage anyway. So I would say the majority actually of the population are women and children of the displaced populations, you know, because often male family members stay behind or they go off to work somewhere else in migrant labor. Well, yes, of course, the cultural constraints. I mentioned the high rate of underage marriage of young girls because it's an income generation strategy. Sometimes they just get married off for livestock, for example, you know. And they often don't necessarily get married off to equal peer, but often to older men, you know, just because it provides more income to the family. In terms of schooling, it's bad for boys and girls because, as I mentioned, there's child labor. So, and many of the women that were interviewed were lamenting the fact that their children are losing out on education because they needed to go and work in the bazaar to get scrap metal or other things. No, it's also boys and girls, you know. So, as terms of access to education and those things, I don't think it's different to the urban poor. And in general, in Afghanistan, it of course, boys have a higher likelihood of access to education than girls. I think there is no distinction really so far for displaced populations. What we have seen, however, is women saying that they have increasingly to work, which in Pashtun families you would not have unless there's a necessity for women to go out to work, particularly when they come from rural homes. They've mentioned that they have to go and clean other people's houses or have to go and work in bakeries, etc. So there is a necessity where the entire family has to pull in. So that's another gender aspect that you could highlight. Of course, widows in the displaced population, but then you also have widows, of course, in the general population of the urban poor are the ones that probably have the least access because they lack a male family member to speak on their behalf, you know. So that is a problem, you know, but that's something I think that needs to increase and look at it. Again, I don't think it differs from the general Afghan population where widows obviously are a vulnerable group.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the audience very much for attending and for your interest in this topic, and I invite you to give the panelists a strong round of applause. Thank you.